This is a CBC podcast.
The president of the internet, the 35-pound football team, and the 1967 iPhone. Those are your keywords. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine. Last week on Search Engine, we brought you the first of a two-part look at how the internet is affecting the upcoming 2008 U.S. presidential election, an election that stands to be the most wired election in U.S. history, probably in world history. Now, we began with a look at the Democratic candidates, how they are making use of the internet, and what the internet's making of them. And we continue today with a look at the Republican candidates. The question we're asking is the internet just another place for politics as usual, or is there a chance for something really extraordinary to happen? And I'm thinking specifically of a candidate by the name of Ron Paul, who you may have been reading about. We're going to get to that in a bit, but first let me welcome back the co-founder of TechPresident.com and PersonalDemocracyForum.com. He's going to guide us through all of this, Micha Sifry. Hello, Micha.
Hi, Jesse. How's it going?
It's good. Now, last week we ended our discussion by going over some of the some of the clips that have been released, not by the candidates themselves, but by their admirers. We talked about Obama Girl and other, aspiring model actresses who have been writing pop songs to the candidates. And what I want to ask you, Micha, is there a chance that, you know, we talk about this being a wonderful populist thing that everybody can participate, but isn't this at risk of just becoming kind of a freak show, sort of a carnival?
Well, I think the carnival started when Bill Clinton went on MTV and answered the question about whether he wore boxers or briefs. And that was, what, 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the intrusion of pop culture into the serious electoral conversation is not a new thing. I think that, you know, the internet, yes, absolutely is part of the erasure of these boundaries more and more. And there's no question that to some degree, it can be a little bit confusing and distasteful and exploitative. I think overall, though, the trend lines are our political process in the United States is being opened up. It is now no longer a game where just the people with money or the people with fame or, you know, huge organizations that they control are in a position to play in the national political conversation. And that's a good thing.
Well, let's talk about people with a lot of money and these big organizations, and let's talk about the main Republican candidates. Have they embraced these sort of mashup YouTube campaign videos and this sort of pop culture aspect of presidential campaigning on the internet with the same passion and the same skill that the Democratic candidates have?
The Democrats in this cycle are a year or two ahead of the Republicans in terms of their skill level. I don't think it's going to take that long for the Republicans to catch up. This is not rocket science. Making a, you know, artful political video mashup is not something that is going to be that hard for them to learn. I'm sure they're watching and taking notes. But you're right. I mean, the you know, the best example I can think off the top of my head of a Republican kind of trying to, you know, push back against one of their opponents was the Romney campaign, Mitt Romney campaign, which noticed after Rudy Giuliani, the current front runner, was caught on tape in the middle of a speech before the National Rifle Association. He gets his cell phone rings.
This is my wife calling, I think. Hello, dear. I'm talking to the members of the NRA right now. Would you like to say hello? I love you, and I'll give you a call as soon as I'm finished, okay? Talk to you later, dear. I love you.
And then the Romney campaign literally dug up old video somebody had where Giuliani does the exact same thing at a speech, you know, several months earlier, gets interrupted with a cell phone call from his wife.
Hello? Stop yelling, Rudy. This is my wife on the phone. Get it. Yeah, I'm doing well. You hear that? Say hello. I'll call you back. I'll call you back, okay? Okay, dear. I love you. Bye.
And, you know, the point was to show this isn't a real, genuine, humanizing interaction you just witnessed, folks, it's just another politician trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
That's pretty embarrassing for Giuliani, Micha. But we should remind our listeners that last week we played a clip of Hillary Clinton caught affecting a Southern accent while addressing a black audience at a Southern church. And what I'm wondering is, can this do real damage, can it? I mean, can people still look at their candidates the same way after they've seen these very embarrassing clips?
One thing you need to remember about these kinds of gotcha moments with video is they're only really damaging when they reveal something about a candidate that A, is, you know, number one, shocking, and B, feeds into something that we already suspect may be the case.
Mm-hmm.
The person who was most badly hurt by this was the senator from Virginia, George Allen, who was caught on tape in the last cycle doing an event where there was this Indian American from the country of India, who he referred to as Makaka.
Inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Makaka here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
In a very aggressive and obnoxious way, you know, implied that he wasn't a real American. And that video was put on the web, and the Jim Webb campaign did a very good job of fanning attention around it. And it ultimately destroyed George Allen. But the reason why it destroyed him is that there was already this accumulating pile of evidence that he actually had some hidden racist elements to his character, that he had a Confederate flag in his college dorm, for example. And there was already a pattern, and this kind of blew it open.
Well, Micha, what you're saying seems to suggest that this is maybe a really positive thing, that in fact, politicians have no choice but to be honest and transparent, because if they put on a false face, they're going to get caught. So, I mean, is this the dream of the internet, that we're going to have a more honest and forthright politics?
I think at the margin, this is where we're going. It's going to be harder for people to get away with literally saying one thing, doing another. The ability to put video side by side, I think, is going to puncture a lot of politicians who try to get away with that kind of two-facedness. But we are still dealing with a generation of people who have honed their skills at obfuscating and trimming and being careful not to say anything. And we can't force them to become new creatures all of a sudden. We can expose the worst, but that's still going to leave us with a lot of ambiguity until I think a new generation comes along, which is much more comfortable with the openness, the interactivity, and feels buoyed by the internet rather than hunted by the internet.
Well, let me ask you about that new generation of candidates, Micha, who actually stand to gain from the internet and to go from being an outsider to maybe having a shot at this thing. I think it's ironic that the one candidate who most embodies this next generation is a 74-year-old Texan. And I'm talking, of course, of Ron Paul. I want you to tell us who Ron Paul is in a moment, but I think probably the best way for us to introduce Ron Paul to our listeners, if they haven't been reading about him already, is with an internet clip, one that interestingly enough, was not cut by Ron Paul, but by one of his many legion of internet supporters who have spliced this internet YouTube clip together on his behalf. Here it is.
What's success for you in this campaign?
What's success? What a win is one is the
That's
goal.
That's not going to happen.
Don Luskin, who's your pro-stock market candidate?
I mean this in all seriousness, Larry. Ron Paul.
Before we go, you can go online and rate the candidates' performances in tonight's debate. Just go to politics.msnbc.com. So far, we've received nearly 2,000 votes. The highest-rated candidate at the moment, Ron Paul, with 39%.
By the way, here's a look at the early results of our text message poll. First place, Ron Paul, surprisingly, 30%.
But I got to tell you, I have never seen so many viewer emails urging us to get a candidate on our air as I have with this particular gentleman. Our mailbox is consistently flooded with these requests.
We've never gotten so many questions on our Dory system for a presidential candidate who has visited Google.
So the darling of the internet, who is Ron Paul?
Well, Ron Paul is turning into the most interesting story of internet politics in 2007 in the U.S., I think. He is a Texas congressman who's been in Congress now, I think, 10 terms. And he is running for president with a powerful combination of messages. Number one, he really believes the United States should not be an empire and it shouldn't be intervening all over the world. We're not the world's policemen and we should be bringing our troops home. He, I think, votes against every foreign aid bill as a matter of principle. There has always been a strong small L libertarian sensibility in America that both parties flirt with, and that he's in particular tapping online because libertarianism online has always been disproportionately evident. You know, people who just think we should be left to our own devices and be self-reliant. That fits with a lot of internet culture. It's a very much a do-it-yourself culture.
Right. And what's interesting to me is that if you ask him, Ron Paul will tell you that he doesn't even understand the internet. This is something that the internet has done to him rather than something that he's actively courted. It seems like he has people who take it upon themselves to write in to these shows and vote for him as the winner of the debates.
And up to this point, there's been a lot of derision. And I think the mainstream media and the mainstream political class has looked at Ron Paul supporters as hyperactive geeks on the web who are artificially inflating his results in these online polls and so on. And, you know, they feel like their candidate, Ron Paul, is being dissed.
Yeah.
He's being ignored. He's not being taken seriously. And one way or the other, we're going to show him.
If there's been an accusation, there have been many, that they're artificially inflating the numbers of support for Ron Paul, I think that his base have done some work to prove that allegation wrong just last week. Can you tell us, Mika, about what happened last week with Ron Paul?
What happened has blown everybody's minds who follows online fundraising. They quietly organized around November 5th a gigantic campaign to pool their money and donate all on the same day. And his campaign took in more than $4.3 million in one day from more than 40,000 individual donors. So we're not talking big donations here, average size around $100. And this is more than anybody has raised in a single day online. So this was kind of Ron Paul's coming out party this week.
This is the utopian dream of participatory democracy on the net, isn't it? That some dark horse candidate will come out of the blue and with a flurry of popular support. People will each give $20 of their pocket or whatever and put him into the White House. Mika, does this guy stand a snowball's chance in hell of being our next president? I'm sorry, of being
no.
your next president.
Well, he's not going to be our next president, but I think he's going to be a big factor in the Republican primary and potentially into the general. He has, he's got more money than John McCain, for example, okay? And, you know, money will keep him going. Besides, he runs a very lean operation, so he doesn't need as much to keep going through the whole primary season. He is a major irritant to the Republican candidates because he's really articulating something that they're trying to suppress, which is this unhappiness with the war, with unhappiness with attacks on civil liberties. And Ron Paul, when asked, will you support the Republican nominee if it isn't you, said not that long ago that if the candidate continues this mindless support for the war, he's not so sure.
Uh-huh.
So, Ron Paul may ultimately go back to where he was before he entered the Republican contest, which is run for president as a libertarian again. Who knows?
Who knows indeed? You know, and what I'm wondering, Mika, is are we going to look back on the 2008 election as the election when we shifted, just as we shifted before with Nixon versus Kennedy, from sort of the radio presidency to the TV presidency? Is this going to be the election that will be remembered as the internet candidacy, the election that was decided by the internet?
I don't want to make technology into an answer to all that ills us. I think the internet is just a tool. It is not a be-all and end-all in determining one way or the other which way that's going to turn out.
Mika, it's going to be an interesting year. Can we check in with you again in a few months?
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much today.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Want nothing more than their freedom.
Okay, now, everybody.
We will continue to follow the U.S. tech election as it progresses, but for now, we're going to leave you with a taste of Ron Paul's supporters. This is a hip-hop group calling themselves Knights of Liberty, who released this YouTube track, Ron Paul for Freedom.
Time to wake up, America. Open your eyelids. See beyond the bureaucratic cloaks and disguises. They're posers and liars, always probing and spying. Quoting the Bible while they're hoarding their bribes in. UN resolutions outweighing the Constitution. Obey them or else they're nuking you. Get it yet? No more YouTube on your internet. Powers derived from loopholes within the text. Forget the rest, it's time for a change. Dr. Ron Paul's wiring brains to enlighten to the spite that's at stake. You better get your weapons licensed today before the rest of your rights are erased and more of our young soldiers' lives are at stake. They say relax, we're your leaders, come on. We wouldn't lie to you. To be safe, we need to stick this microchip inside you. Spread your feet a little wider. Any weed or psilocybin? You were speeding, sir. Cavity searches are required. If you don't like the state taking food off your plate, say vote for Ron Paul in 2008. And if you don't want the IRS repossessing your place, then vote for Ron Paul in 2008. We got troops in Afghanistan, troops in Iraq. Where's our troops at if we do get attacked? Troops out in Africa, troops in Korea. Where are troops gonna be if they do come over here? If you don't like the state taking food off your plate, say vote for Ron Paul in 2008. And if you don't want the IRS repossessing your place, then vote for Ron Paul in 2008.
Last week on Search Engine, we talked about an Industry Canada study which proved that people who download music through peer-to-peer networks are much more likely to also buy CDs than those who don't. We invited you to come discuss the study and our coverage of it in an open forum on our blog, and some of you did. Several of our commenters felt strongly that our coverage wrongly suggested that file downloads are actually good for the music industry. If you'd like to read those opinions or add to them, our forum remains open. Come to cbc.ca/search engine and look for the blog item asking who needs the protection, artists or listeners. If you've ever been in a crowded sports bar, you know that most fans think that they know more than the coach about how their favorite team should be run. Now there's a British website giving sports fans the chance to prove it. It's an online experiment that just might change the whole way professional sports teams are managed. Myfootballclub.uk.co.com charges each of its 53,000 members £35, about $70, to buy an equal stake in a crowd-owned, crowd-managed soccer team. Tim Wynne-Jones is one of My Football Club's organizers. And of course, one of its many owners, and we reached him at his home in London. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Tim, what prompted you to create this idea, myfootballclub.com?
Well, it was actually the idea of a guy called Will Brooks, who was I used to work with. He's a friend of mine. And I think what prompted it was two things, really. One, the growing number of foreign owners who are coming into English football, sort of multi-millionaire or billionaire businessmen from the United States or Eastern Europe who are coming in and buying English football clubs. And I think creating a bit of suspicion amongst the fans as to what their motives might be. And the other thing is this factor that fans are being more and more sidelined in football. It used to be called the people's game in Britain, and these days fans, I think, feel like they're not really treated as a vital part of the game. You know, they're really just kind of paying customers rather than somebody who's part of the fabric of the football club. So we wanted to try and redress that and give fans a bit more power and a bit more of a say in the way their football clubs run, and felt that the best way to do that was to actually buy a football club and let the fans run it.
And how many owners do you have?
I'm not sure the exact figure. We had 50,000 people register. This was in the first phase. They registered their interest, and then we asked for the money, and the money has come in. And I think not all of those 50,000 have paid yet, but we've raised over £700,000. So, I mean, a good number of them have paid. There's tens of thousands of owners out there, you know, who've all been brought together via the internet. I mean, it's an incredible use of the internet, and incredible the response that we've had from it.
It is amazing. So everybody, you know, maybe you could just tell me briefly how it works. Everybody kicks in how much money?
Yeah, everybody pays £35 a year. So initially, that goes towards buying the club, and then anything that's left over sits in a trust the supporters' trust actually owns the club then, and the money that's put in sits in that trust and is used to buy players or improve the stadium or any other aspect of the club that needs money spent on it.
And everyone's an equal partner in this? I mean, you're an organizer, but you don't own any more of this team than any
No,
else?
No, absolutely. Everybody has one equal share within that supporters' trust.
Now, how do you guys make decisions about which players to go for? I mean, how do decisions get made?
They're made via the net, quite simply. I think there'll be a head coach who will prepare the team during the week, as with any other club, and he will brief the members on the website every week, let them know what he thinks, you know, who he thinks is doing well and, you know, how people are performing and a bit about maybe the opposition. And then all the members can digest that information and vote for the team that they, you know, the selection that they would like to see run out on the Saturday. And it's basically calculated by the computer and the team is decided that way. It's very straightforward.
This reminds me of, fantasy baseball leagues and stuff like that. But this is no fantasy. You have this money collected and have you bought a team yet?
It is very similar to the principle behind fantasy leagues. But as you said, it's no fantasy. This is fantasy football made real. In terms of the team, we have agreed a deal in principle with a club, and it's going through the due diligence at the moment. So we're hoping that we can announce who they are in the coming weeks, maybe in the next couple of weeks.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this is sort of a reaction against sort of these Russian oligarchs coming in and buying British football teams and American businessmen doing the same. How do you think this is going to measure up against their efforts? Do you think that 50,000 Englishmen can run a team better than an outside interest like that?
Well, that's the beauty of it. I mean, that's the big test, isn't it? It's an experiment to see if football fans' views really do hold sway when it comes to putting them into action. Our hunch is that they do, and that's why we're doing it, because we think that fans know an awful lot about football and have a very good understanding, especially when they follow a club intimately and understand often the character of that club. And I think just the process, you know, that whole wisdom of crowds theory, making sensible decisions, I think this will show that can work. How it compares to the oligarchs and people who are owning clubs already is a difficult one to answer, because some of them have been successful and some haven't. So I think we'll be more successful than quite a few of them.
Tim, this is going to change the whole nature of pub room arguments. You know, when two guys start opining about what should be done, they can actually get online and do something about it, huh?
Exactly. And, it's about time, isn't it? You know, for hundreds of years, people have stood around opining, as you say, about their football club and moaning about it, but being completely powerless to do anything about it. At last, something's being done about that.
Do you think that this is a precedent for other sporting organizations? Do you think this is an idea that could spread?
The way people have cottoned onto it shows that it certainly makes sense for a lot of people. They see that it's workable, it's practical, and therefore it can be applied to any other kind of sport.
Is there going to be an owner's box at the stadium?
Well, the whole stadium becomes an owner's box, really, because, you know, if everyone who owns it turns up, you know, that could be 50,000 people in the stadium. So it would have to be a very, very, very big stadium to have a dedicated owner's box for all those people.
Tim, thanks so much for talking with me about this.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Since we talked to Tim Wynne-Jones earlier this week, my football club has bought a team. Ebbsfleet United FC now has over 50,000 new owners. You can follow the team's progress or even pony up some money and join in. Members from outside England are welcome to join the crowd. Just go to myfootballclub.co.uk.com. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, a radio show that predicts the present. Nevertheless, from time to time, we find ourselves distracted by the past. That's because an explosion of digital archiving has seen thousands of forgotten old recordings and pictures and texts being dusted off, digitized, and placed just a few clicks away from anyone, anywhere. This access to the past is one of the coolest things about living in the future. And from time to time, we'll bring you some of these rediscovered treasures in a feature we call Flipback, our parting look at what's new in old. Today we take you back to June 15th, 1967. A British conference is exploring leisure time in the future, and the CBC is there to speculate on tomorrow's telephone.
What do you do when you have nothing to do? Well, it appears that modern technology, instead of solving the problem, is aggravating it. In Britain, according to the British Postmaster General, the telephone of the future will do so much of the work you now do that some of your muscles may become obsolete. In Montreal, experts from 180 organizations from across the country have been discussing the problem of leisure time, and there, too, it would seem people are heading for lots of time on their hands and nothing to do with it. First to London, and a description of what the telephone of the future will do to you. Michael McClear reports.
So you get that feeling you left the bathroom tap running. So you just dial your number, and TV scanners check around the house while you watch on the view phone. Or it could be a new way of babysitting, or maybe keeping an eye on the wife. But whether you're at home or out, the phone of the future will be doing most of the chores. It will even do your cooking, if you're to believe Britain's Postmaster General Edward Short. By the end of the century, he told a conference on telecommunications, electrical appliances could be, as he put it, commanded over the phone. You call from the office or the hen party, and by the time you get home, dinner is ready. As for shopping, no need to get out of bed. Dial the supermarket and look it over on the view phone. Tap out a code for the goods you want, and simultaneously a computer will keep a running account. But of course, some poor guy has to deliver the stuff. Sometime around 1984, the phone will be linked to a teleprinter. Make a theater or an airline booking, and the printer punches out the tickets. Or call a code word, like CBC, and get the very latest news. These push-button codes could bring you any tape recording or film library information and, conceivably, revolutionize education and leisure time. A great game, if you don't lose the use of your legs.
Well, we here at the CBC are still speculating on the phones of the future. Starting this Monday, cbc.ca/technology will launch a week-long feature series on tomorrow's cell phones and the impact that they'll likely have on everything from our economy to our culture. That's at cbc.ca/technology starting this Monday. Search Engine is produced by myself, Jeff Siskind, Andrew Parker, our intern Tashanta Pombwa, and the Search Engine online community. We make this show through online collaboration. To get involved, visit our site, cbc.ca/search engine, where you'll also find links and discussion on every story we've talked about today, plus our podcast. You can also find us on the Facebook group Search Engine CBC or by email at searchengine@cbc.ca. Special thanks this week to Ron DeBeeb. I'm Jesse Brown. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.